OTB AM.
In association with AIR, get AIR Sport free with AIR Broadband.
And a very good morning to you. You're welcome along to Tuesday's Off the Ball AM. I hope you had a very good extended weekend. I think anybody who's interested in AIR Sport in any way had a pretty awesome weekend. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Rory McIlroy's amazing performance and his rekindled chances at the Masters. Nathan's going to join us just after 9 o'clock. We're going to talk about the hurling. Offaly are ankle county close. There was a 65 shootout in the Clare Limerick game in the hurling league. So despite the fact that there was masses of matches called off over the course of the weekend, there's still loads to talk about. Doughty Regan's going to join us at about 8:30. But obviously, we are obsessing about the fact that Ireland are the greatest rugby team in the world. Screw you, New Zealand. We are the greatest team in the world right now this week. If we played them today, tomorrow and the next day, we'd beat them three times. That's what I'm saying.
It depends where we're playing them. If we're playing them in Twickenham, of course we will beat them.
Oh, hockey them.
Twickenham is now our new favourite ground. It was regal, I felt, on Saturday in an ironic sense. We just kind of strolled up in our kind of our pub mobile of sorts and was like, crown us now, the English. Give us the crown, give us your crown, give us the Grand Slam crown that you failed to win last year. We are far superior than you. This thing isn't even going to be a contest,
yeah.
Which ended up being the case. And, you know, maybe there isn't that deep sense of, I guess, joy and relief that you had in 09, but it was just this slow burn of satisfaction throughout the 80 minutes.
Yeah, you're still like, so as a supporter out there, you're kind of still like, this could go wrong, just because you've watched Irish sport all your life where stuff goes wrong, and then it's like, this isn't going to go wrong, there's no way. Like, we look at us, we're way better than this team. But still, until like it's 77 minutes on the clock, you're like, they could score a crappy try and there'd be another crappy try and it'd be robbery. Like, we're clearly better, but it didn't happen.
No. Part of me at the time kind of felt that would have been a record win, obviously, in Twickenham had Owen Farrell not scored that late try. But then I'm like, what the hell am I doing?
Yeah.
Why am I getting wound up about this thing? This is one of the greatest Irish sporting achievements ever because of the fact, I think this achievement is wrapped up in the idea that the main emotion in this country is excitement. This doesn't feel like a full stop. This doesn't feel like it did in 09 when it was like, finally, at last, we've done this thing. This Grand Slam feels like a stepping stone.
Yeah, although I think that if you flip the games around, we beat England in the first game at Twickenham and we just beat France with a drop goal in the last minute to win it, then everybody would feel the same. Oh my God, I can't believe that. So we nearly blew it. Whereas actually, we nearly blew it in the first game when Teddy Thomas. So like, it doesn't feel like it's the end for this team, obviously,
no.
Because there are so many kids in it, comparatively. But at the same time, I think the manner of the victory probably means everybody's a little bit more complacent than we need to be about stuff like this.
Well, complacency is good. I mean, complacency means you feel you're in a good space, and feeling that you're in a good space is a good sign of anything, really, isn't it?
Well, I think we all felt like we were in a good space heading into the 2007 World Cup when, you know, we'd put together 18 months of beautiful, brilliant attacking rugby. We had strength and depth, you know, some options at various places.
Maybe for this week only, let's not talk about past World Cups. Let's just talk about the one next year, which we're 100% definitely going to win. But in general, when you look at the scenes of jubilation over the last couple of days, you think of Rob Kearney's quotes over the last week when he's like, I didn't really appreciate 09 that much. Well, 09, I don't think it was possible to appreciate it as much because you're coming off that pitch in the Millennium Stadium thinking to yourself, holy crap, that game was incredible. Whereas with England, it kind of felt like, okay, there was a bit of a wind down in the match to a certain extent, and there was a build up to the Grand Slam itself, rather than this microcosm of kind of excitement that occurred in Wales on that afternoon.
And some of the English fans leaving early always helps.
You were there, obviously.
Yeah,
what was it like? It was kind
was
of
class.
A constant stream
like,
of...
Twickenham's a brilliant place to go and watch rugby. Like, in fairness to the English rugby fans, although some of them did leave, very few of them left early. Most of them stayed until the last try was scored. They celebrated the second last try and they celebrated the last try, like just as a, oh, we support our team kind of thing, as opposed to, you know, turning on the head coach or turning on the players and booing. But yeah, it's a brilliant place to win because like swing low is a deep guttural thing that seizes power and rumbles around the whole stadium and you're like, oh, that must be a bit intimidating for the players. And then, mistake after mistake after mistake makes the crowd stop singing and the Irish crowd starts singing and suddenly it's like, well, actually, you know what? We're by far the superior team here.
Mm.
It was brilliant. Like, I love Twickenham and they're a really good crowd of people who were like, well, actually, that does look like that was a penalty. You know, that was a good decision by the referee when we're winning another penalty as opposed to, you know, booing him for stuff.
Yes.
They did want Bundy Aki yellow carded.
Well,
they were pretty certain Bundy Aki should have got yellow carded.
Was there not a certainty on this side of the water as well that he probably should have got yellow carded?
He could have been yellow carded. I don't think you would have complained too much given the rules of the game. The fact that it was head to head and kind of accidental, I mean, it's like he did headbutt your man, make it look like a tackle, get away with it, bit of camouflage.
That's all part of the process. But was there like a big Irish operation in terms of like stealing 10,000 tickets off the English and turning Twickenham into just a fortress of green?
I do think because England weren't playing for the Grand Slam that there were more tickets floating about than there normally would have been. Like when the stadium empties, you get a chance to see how many Irish people stuck around, and quite a few Irish people did stick around. So there was definitely an opportunity for Irish people to get tickets in a way that there might not have been traditionally. But I knew a lot of people out there as well who went out to the ground and ended up watching it on the big screens around the area. Which obviously means that there weren't as many as perhaps they thought there would be.
No, absolutely. Like, is there a level about this that it's almost beyond belief that we kind of, everything lined up so perfectly that first of all, it's an even number year. So you got to win in Paris, you got to win in Twickenham.
Never going to happen.
Also, the way the fixtures happened, England were last. Also, the way the fixtures happened, Ireland have won every game going to Twickenham. And also, you've got these incredible comments from Eddie Jones, which nobody really cares about, but we got ourselves worked up because we want to get worked up about something.
Nobody got worked up though, really, did they?
I mean, in a completely faux way.
Only the English media got worked up because they're like, oh, you can't coach the Lions now, Eddie. You've screwed that up. The Welsh are never going to... I mean, Wales are like, well, we are a pretty small little country.
I don't think this thing has sunk in. This is the best possible way to win any competition. It has just worked out so perfectly.
Crushing England in England.
It's almost too good. I think give it a couple of days and that's when the celebrations will really begin. We'll just wake up on Friday morning and come in, lads, do you remember what we did last weekend?
Yeah, I think that maybe it would have been better if it hadn't been on a bank holiday weekend so that like you could have 3 full days of gloating and lording. It seems like we might be overdoing it a little bit by still going on about it, but actually... I've barely spoken about it.
It's only Tuesday.
I know, we've got a full couple of months of this, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, we should just remind everybody every day that we won the Grand Slam in Twickenham with a crushing display. Under the thumb. England are under our thumb. Time for the papers.
OTB
AM. In association with AIR. Get AIR Sport free with AIR Broadband.
Let us start with the Irish Times this morning. They are leading with the rugby. Ireland's triumph of the collective sees them dominate individually. Gerry Thorney's team at a tournament there. Sexton just pips Murray as player of the tournament for his Paris heroics. On the back of the Irish Independent then, they're going with that incredible game in the Gaelic rounds yesterday evening. 100 minutes, 58 scores, 14 frees, 2 periods of extra time and 1 winner. Limerick beating Clare in the Allianz Hurling League quarter final in Division 1. Colin Ryan of Limerick there scoring the winning 65 in that free-taking competition. It's also the same story on the front of the Irish Examiner this morning. The never-ending story reads the headline. Ryan hits sudden death winner as Limerick edge out Clare in historic league shootout. Meanwhile, on the back of the Irish Daily Mail, free-for-all reads the headline. Ryan the hero for treaty after 100 minutes of drama.
So I'm just reading a comment from Jeremy Guscott. Ireland don't have any world-class players, but they're playing well as a team. Thanks, Jeremy. I mean, Clark Furlong, definitely not the best tight-head prop in the world. And our 9 and 10, definitely not the best 9 and 10 in the world at the moment. I mean, Beauden Barrett's very good, but Johnny Sexton is just as good. And so therefore, you would have a tough decision picking between them. That's the definition of world-class. Rice sticking with Ireland. This is the story about Declan Rice. Apparently, hasn't actually been contacted yet by England about potentially switching over to play for them. Rice, I only want to play for Ireland. This is obviously the piece that he did at the weekend at the FAI Awards. He was our young player of the year. No, Cyrus Christie was our young player of the year at age 25. I think that's actually true. I think he is actually 25 and he is our young player of the year.
That definitely did happen. I Wikipedia'd it when I saw him in the awards, and I'm still, it still makes me doubt.
I mean, a lot of stuff going on over the weekend. I'm not sure it did happen, right?
I just kind of like, I couldn't understand it, so I just said, time to make it night two of Grand Slam celebrations.
Injury blows rock Munster. A terrible weekend for Munster, obviously. Keith Earls expected to face a lengthy layoff with his knee injury. He was hobbling around on one leg during the celebrations. But Tyler Blaindell out for the rest of the season with a recurrence of the neck injury. He's had surgery, and Duncan Williams out for about 8 weeks, it looks like, with a fractured eye socket and a fractured cheekbone after a training incident. So Chris Farrell already gone, and a couple of others suffering injuries as well. So Toulon rolling around very soon, just 11 days away from that game in the Champions Cup. Declan Ireland, the only team I want to play for. This is Declan Rice. And then Deschamps, I help Pogba, French manager Didier, to talk to unhappy star Paul. So I don't know if Didier Deschamps is going to still be the French manager after the World Cup. Who knows? Shirt, sharp shock. Jose, you lot must show more respect to the badge. I don't know if you can see from the photograph there, but Jose Mourinho is pointing to the Aeon logo underneath the Manchester United badge. And I don't know if he's actually like, it's, you know, it's just, these sponsors aren't paying money to be associated with the crap that you're showing up. Or did he mean to actually point at the badge as the thing that he respects most? I'm sure it was the badge and not the money. Definitely wasn't the money that Jose was pointing at going, Aeon. Darren O'Dea, there's no grey area with drink driving, but Gibson needs help. This is the story that Darren Gibson will appear in court next month after he was charged with drink driving. The Sunderland midfielder was suspended by the club after his arrest on Saturday following reports of a collision near their training ground. And Jose's Ramray, this is a story that Jose Mourinho is weighing up a swoop for Aaron Ramsey. I can't believe there's transfer gossip leading the back pages of the tabloids already when we're, what, like 4 months away from the, 6 months away from the closing of the transfer, 5 months from the closing of the transfer deadline. Shoot me now.
Front of the Racing Post is asking the question about the future of Sam Crowe, champion hurdle or chase. Where should Chickenstown go with the exceptional Sam Crowe? On the back page then, it's all Joe Hart there and whether or not he'll get selected by Gareth Southgate for England. The Daily Telegraph then, across the channel, things have got to change, reads the headline here. Players' chief says England must address taboo subject of essential contracts of Eddie Jones' side is going to compete with the best in the world.
Read every word of the English press and the protestations that they have about the way that their game is set up. Read every syllable of this that you possibly can and enjoy it, because this is the, these are the spoils of victory.
It's been a long time coming. It's not, unfortunately, a big grim back page in The Guardian. It's Mo Salah.
One of the things I heard in America about the future of English rugby is that they're just waiting for the good teams in the first division to get up to the Premiership, and then they're going to, the relegation trapdoor will be closed and they'll get rid of relegation, effectively having a Celtic League style, at which point you can begin to charge the union a bunch of money to centrally contract your players, and that will improve English rugby. But it'll also mean that a bunch of the world's best players head to England.
Or it also means that the best young English players who might be as yet unearthed gems and are playing in the championship in England might not get their chance. It's like, actually, we've got a load of money here. Why not recruit some second string player from South Africa or New Zealand and let's turn them into the top player instead of their own homegrown talent? So I'm all for that. If it's going to continue the downfall of English rugby, then I'm all for that.
Right, okay. So let's move on. Let's bring in some Gary Ringrose here. Here he is talking immediately in the aftermath of Saturday's win to Oisin Langan about Ireland's strength and depth.
Yeah, it's an amazing position to be in as a country, considering there's four guys, probably five or six guys, if not more, between all the provinces. You know, we've been battling out for the 12 and 13 with a lot of guys capable of playing both numbers. So, that's from my point of view, reiterating what Chris said, there was some incredible work put in by Robbie and then himself, and it was trying to, match that.
I hadn't seen that video. He took a hell of a beating. Was absolutely sensational. Like, better again than he was last week. He was brilliant last week, considering it was first game back in ages. Here's some Jordan Larmour, who obviously saw a fair bit of game time as well.
I think just like we went out with a mindset to go after the game, go after England. Like, we had to go out and take our chances and grab them with both hands. and then just to have just belief in your own product. Don't shy away from any challenges, just front up. And
It's a good question. When do they name player of the tournament? Alan, how are you?
Hi, how are you, Ger? How are you?
Fairly soon, I think, isn't it? So the shortlist was published yesterday. Sexton's on it. Murray was on it. They were the only two Irish, were they?
I think so. I think they were fantastic. People talk about how important they are to the Irish team. And before the weekend, I think I was my thoughts and a lot of people's thoughts are, if they play well, if Sexton Murray go well, Ireland will be in a great position. Sexton is extraordinary. The amount of physical contact, the bangs, the knocks he gets, and missing that penalty in the first
Stockdale.
Half.
Stockdale as well.
Yeah, sensational return from him, but. They're so important to the side, and there was probably period of play there midway through the second half, even towards the end of the game, where I think Murray made so many tackles in one phase of play. He made three tackles, I counted, and just his covering across the field and the way he was getting into the defensive line and, you know, giving assurance to guys inside and outside. He covers so much ground. He was just sensational throughout the tournament.
Keith Earls also nominated, so four Irish players, not two.
Yeah, Earls, he was good as well. Massive loss for Munster now, yeah. Which is not
hasn't
good
been diagnosed yet, but it looks like it was something serious enough.
It's his medial ligament. I spoke to him after the game, and he wasn't optimistic. I think when I saw him out on the field with his kids afterwards, I said, maybe it's not too bad, and I saw the ice pack on it, and but he wasn't too optimistic after the game, which is another massive blow for Munster coming with the Champions Cup coming up.
Medial might not mean surgery, it might mean recuperation.
Yeah, it depends on the medial. It could be if it's grade 3 or grade 2, grade 1, depending how serious and how much damage is done there. You're looking at six weeks possibly, you know, so it's another massive blow for him. He's been sensational throughout the tournament, just looks so electric every time he touches the ball.
What do you think is going through England's minds when they see Johnny Sexton bloodied and playing a brilliant game, Jacob Stockdale with that outrageous try, CJ Sander with 100 people hanging off him as he charges down in the line? Like, they must be thinking, this is an unstoppable beast that is so finely tuned that they're unstoppable.
Yeah, when you're at the game on, and we were doing the commentary, Dave McIntyre and myself, and you're kind of looking down and you just see body language as well sometimes. And just even at that period when Peter O'Mahony got sin-binned. They were battering the Irish line and Ireland were repelling them, stopping them, getting off the line, getting in their faces. And you see the body language and players just look a little bit dejected. And I know if I'm in that environment myself, you're like, what else do we have to do to get that score? And the game was just slipping away from them. And they were putting so much... to be honest, I think the uncertainty around the changes and stuff, it's not a bad English side. I think if he played, it's probably their strongest side that he could possibly select for Eddie Jones, but they look dejected and the effort levels. Like if you look at some of the players, Henderson, Furlong, James Ryan, they're just so abrasive and energetic in their tackles and they were sensational. Levy was unbelievable. And they stopped momentum of Vunipola, Robshaw, Simmons wasn't in the game.
Robshaw wasn't in the game really either.
No, they weren't. And they were trying to batter away. And to be fair, Hartley made a lot of carries from them. And they were running unbelievably hard. And they were just meeting a wall of Irish players. So it goes back to the thing of freshness. And Ireland looked really fresh. They looked like so much energy and enthusiasm. And England looked a bit fatigued.
Can I just talk about the fatigue briefly? Because all the English papers are blaming the amount of minutes that the players have played. But I heard Will Greenwood talking about having been given access to a training session that Eddie Jones had. And he absolutely flays his players. He wants them to be training in that training session and come off it feeling like they've played a test match. I'm like, well, fair enough. I mean, maybe that works for a team who hasn't done loads of minutes, but like it's up to him then to get the balance right, to know that okay, I've seen that Anthony Watson's played 1200 minutes or whatever it is, which is like 900 more than most of the Irish lads, so maybe I'm not going to kill him in training this week. Maybe we're just going to walk through it. Like, it's not just the fault of the Premiership, and it's not just the fault of the way that the players have to play for their clubs. It's also the responsibility of the coach to recognise this and to take action.
Well, it's a really interesting point, and I met a lot of English internationals before and after the game, and it was the common consensus that this team are overtrained. So if you look at someone like Mauro Itoje, he probably had six games for Saracens before the Irish lines are being integrated back in with their provinces here. It's a lot of minutes.
Yeah.
Plus their pre-season is shorter. So the key for me, Ger, here is if you have to play a long season ahead. And you often hear it from players over the years, is you get a really good pre-season, it's like fuel in the tank. So you're strengthening the shoulders, you're getting the core right, you're getting the fitness levels, you're building a really good base. And plus, you're keeping contact out of that period for that five, six, seven weeks, whatever it is from the in the off-season, and you're conditioning the body. So you're getting your fitness levels up to a level, and then you're maintaining by managing the workload and stuff like that. I'm really surprised with all the modern technology and the GPS numbers or computer systems they have where they monitor individual players. that this fatigue isn't showing up in their systems. But ultimately, minutes at the end of the day can be mental fatigue as well. It can be like, God, week after week after week, we're going again. And the system here enables players to have a rest, a week off. The province, if someone has a little niggle in one of the provinces in a Pro 14 game, they won't play. And someone else will bring a massive amount of enthusiasm who's frustrated that they're maybe not a starter. So it doesn't affect the performance, the team performance as much. They have that bit of wriggle room. It's a frustration. You hear Wales talking about it, you hear England talking about it, and they changed the whole format of the Heineken Cup because of this. Well, the Irish are able to rest their players, they don't pick their best players, but it pays dividend. And the national team here is the money earner for all the provinces. So success with the national team generates way more funds, and that's the primary goal for the RFU, and it's paid off. You think with the resources England have that they could manage that a little bit better, but the problem they have is with the clubs. They're fighting against the clubs in a similar situation, not as bad as France, but if you can't manage your players, and that's the luxury that Joe Schmidt has. So Johnny Sexton is 450 or 60 minutes. Farrell is nearly 1,200 minutes as well.
And so knowing all that then, you don't kill them when they come in training. Like, so Eddie Jones has to take
some responsibility. So last Wednesday, give you an example, he gave him Tuesday off, so it was a rest on Tuesday, and then he brings them out Wednesday, and they're out at 8:30 Wednesday morning, and they do an hour and a half of full-on contact. That's a couple of days before a
massive test game.
It is, and when I played, and I think you have to do a certain amount of contact during the week, even after good wins, a loss. Sometimes when you have the loss, you get flogged. Sometimes when you have the loss, it's maybe talk about it and make sure the attitude is right and the heads are right. You have to have an element of contact. Is that hitting pads or is it hitting body on body? And he had a body on body session on Wednesday, which even though the players probably at the time, you know, they're up for it and they're getting stuck in and they feel maybe great, they've got that bit of aggression out, and it does help if it goes wrong and there's a bit of fatigue. So the previous part of the tournament, these underlying kind of vibes are coming out that we're overtraining. What Eddie Jones is trying to do is replicate the Matt situation as much as he can. And he did an article, I read a great article a few weeks ago, where that's his primary goal and that's what he thinks the way to win Matt test matches is. Replicate training. It's all well and good, but the body and the mind have to be kind of rested and relaxed as well. And I think he got that balance wrong.
Do you get a sense that the English players are now starting to feel that as well? That they're looking around?
Well, when you hear these little vibes coming out, so the ex-players are chatting to guys they know within the squad, and it's coming out that, you know, God, we have another long session, or we're flat on our feet and we're exhausted from the week's training. And it only takes two players to start mentioning that to someone else. And then somebody else goes, yeah, I feel a little bit fatigued. And maybe. And then when the losses are there, you tend to go towards that in your own mind, that this is why we're losing, because we're overtraining. I'm surprised, because most professional teams, whether it be club or international, they have a leadership group who give that feedback to coaches. But I think Eddie Jones is fairly bullish that this is what he wants. He'll review the tournaments now and they'll look back, and I guarantee you the feedback coming from the players that we overtrained.
So it's not...
If you have someone like Greenwood who's been in around the session, he knows a lot of the guys, he's saying it openly on Sky Sports yesterday, that's the case. They're being overtrained.
Yeah, it definitely feels that way. To go back to Ireland, we'll go back to Ireland in a minute. Let's hear from some Joe Schmidt. Here he is talking about how well the younger players handle themselves during the game on Saturday.
At the same time, you know, had Gary Ringrose really grow in stature and boss that back line with young Joey inside at 10 and outside with Jordan and even Jacob, he's still a kid. I think people, because he's played every game and he's done incredibly well and he's growing and learning, people maybe take for granted that he actually hasn't had that much rugby at this level, or even provincial level for that matter.
Yeah, it was some shine that Gary Ringrose had. Andy Dunn, good morning to you. How are you?
Hi, Jerry.
We're just revelling in this, picking apart the faults of the English rugby system. But we should talk about our own for like a couple of minutes, because this is the triumph of the entire rugby culture and rugby system. When you look at the amount of kids who are in the squad, when you look at the amount of essentially rookies who are now first teamers, so Dan Levy was supposed to be holding this jersey for a period of time until Van der Fleer comes back from injury, or until Maybe Reece Ruddock, but definitely until Sean O'Brien comes back. And now it's like, he's our number one, number seven at the minute, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's. I don't think it's in his nature to hold a jersey for others. The type of guy he is. I spoke to John Fogarty, who's the Leinster forwards coach, about 2 years ago. He had flagged with me and a couple of others in the same conversation how good this guy was, and what he was bringing to even to training was this level of toughness and being so combative and physical in training. Even as a young guy, he was trying to lay down a marker in training sessions. So yeah, it doesn't seem like it's in his nature to come in and sit and hold the seat warm for Josh van der Fleyer or Sean O'Brien. And I think that's exactly what is happening across the breadth of the squad. I think we had seven lads on the field at the tail end of Saturday under the age of 23, winning a Grand Slam. It's pretty amazing.
Seven who never lost a game for Ireland. It's unbelievable. Yeah. I always think back here of when all these young guys coming through was when Leo picked all these rookies 2 years ago against Bath when they were, you know, they'd lost, was it four at that stage or five Champions Cup games? And it just gives guys an opportunity. And when imagine the amount of young guys in all the provinces now will see the likes of Ryan, Stockdale, Carberry, Larmour and say, well, I can do that. It actually gives you a shot of confidence. When I was kind of coming through into the Irish squad, you're looking at guys 23, 24, 25 who've been there, done a lot of stuff, and you're thinking, God, what'll I be like in that environment? Am I confident enough to be there? The confidence levels, and I think, you know, you've got to give Joe Schmidt massive credit for that, to be able to give them confidence. But I think the intriguing thing is, for a young player to come in and they get the detail, they get the information, they process it, they know their role, what ruck they're hitting, what line they're running, where they're supposed to go. They're probably in fear of making a mistake or error in that system. But they repeat it so much, they have to know it so much, that then when they go out and do it and they start, this stuff starts paying off, they go, this is, I'm able to do this. They're not thinking about, God, am I, you know, looking around at the surroundings and maybe looking at the opposition players. They start believing, then they start to execute and they go, well, this, I'm fine with this. This is what I can do, no problem. And then the natural talent kind of pays dividend, you know. So it's incredible.
Well, I think you touched on, Jared, it's a culmination of over, 20 odd years of when the game went professional in 95. Originally there was discussions, would the clubs become professional?
Yeah.
The club game was huge. And you were involved in whatever, five or six All-Ireland winning titles with Shannon, and back in the early 90s, Sky Sports were covering Young Munster against Black Rock in the All-Ireland League. So someone somewhere made a really, really, you know, insightful and incredibly smart decision to say, we'll do provincial rugby as professional, make those our clubs. And now I think
the system was there, Andy, wasn't it? We had our provinces, so it was a natural thing, and we're the envy of most of the world with the system. And probably there's a bit of frustration. And it's why the Heineken Cup went to the Champions Cup and this change happened. Because the English were frustrated about the way we were able to rest players and the system we're in. But it's paying dividends. We haven't a huge base of professional players, but to be able to put it all together is phenomenal.
That's all clearly very important, right? And that's the architecture of how it's supposed to work. But clearly the biggest thing that we have going in this country is the school system. And the school system obviously comes in for a lot of criticism because it's very elitist, and the amount of money and resources that it gets is huge. And sometimes the best young youth players are harvested off and offered scholarships and taken away from their clubs. And fair enough, that's all. And there's probably too much emphasis placed on it by the individual schools. And yet it is also the best academy system in any sport. It's right up there with La Masia at Barcelona. Listening to Stuart Lancaster talking about the difference between Ireland and England is like the school system. Like, you come over here and you see the quality of coaching. They're getting strength and conditioning from the time they're 13. They're getting skills coaches from the time they're 13 all the way through to the age of 18. Like, the fact that a bunch of players could basically walk from St. Michael's to the Leinster team to the Ireland team and win Grand Slams.
The pathway is very clear. The pathway is very clear, and for young players, they now have the ambition to go on those steps, if you like. But you think of all the private schools in the UK, surely that system there.
I think a lot of players get
lost as well in the system, and it's phenomenal. And to be fair, Dublin is you see the evidence is there in that team. You look at all the young players we're talking about, Barr, Stockdale, they're coming out of the Leinster Academy, and it's a numbers game up here as well. And that's not a bitter Munster player person
and something
that
needs to be done to make sure that's not just
schools,
the only way, the only
it's
pathway.
Number of schools, and they've come through, these guys. It's phenomenal. I think this team will be judged ultimately, fairly or unfairly. Unfairly, I think, because we know you can't take away from a Grand Slam and go, well, we've got to do something in the World Cup now. You can't take away this bit of success from them. But the naysayers will say, well, can we do it at a World Cup? And that is a challenge now. How do they address it going forward, Ger, and how they manage the pressure and expectation?
Yeah.
Because if I'm playing against, you know, some of these young guys, James Ryan, I'm on my toes. He's going to get that every week now.
Yeah.
The attention is there with them. So it's how they handle that going forward.
We'll talk a bit more about that. I know you've got to go. Before you go, tell us, who's your player of the tournament?
Look, Stockdale's return is phenomenal. It's just phenomenal, the amount of tries. Earls was brilliant. Sexton, of course, you know, for that drop goal, that moment. And just his resilience and strength sometimes in adverse situations. His physicality. I think of a tackle he made against Ross Moriarty against Wales right in the line. He just puts his body in the line. But for me, I think Murray's all-round game, his ability to kick, defend, make line breaks, bring guys into the game. He's sensational. Overall consistent contribution. He makes some errors on occasion. He's not completely immune to an error, but his level of consistency has been phenomenal throughout this tournament, and such a leader, so calm as well. So yeah. I think for me it's Murray.
Who have you got?
Furlong.
Right, that's interesting, because here's Dennis Hickey talking about Furlong being in the mix for World Rugby Player of the Year. Hickey was speaking on Sunday's Off the Ball.
Talked a lot about Tadhg Furlong already. He's, you know, I think he'll probably be himself, Sexton and Murray. Certainly, if Leinster have a strong European Cup, he'd be there, thereabouts for World Player of the Year, I would say, by the end of the season.
Is Furlong, is he a freak that Ireland are lucky to have? Or is he actually, when you look at these systems that are in place in Irish rugby that have been developed over the last 10, 15 years, is he almost a prototype of that coming to fruition?
I think it's a bit of both. I don't think you could create a player just out of the system, a player like him. Obviously, he's a very skillful player. He is an incredible athlete. Like, he holds 20 stone around for 60, 70 minutes. And I was watching him yesterday before they took him off, and because I was thinking, I wonder if they're going to bring Andrew Porter on. But the impact at collisions, the impact, the cleanouts he was doing, like up to the minute before he was taken off, was almost as intense as it was after the first couple of minutes. So he's a phenomenal athlete, you know, to be able to do that, to be able to have that athleticism and engine just to be able to keep going, considering what front row fours have to do, pushing, scrumming, rucking, etc., lifting, and then the presence around the field. And he's got great hands. Clearly, he's got great hands. He's a very good footballer as well. So,
pretty good footballer. It was amazing. It's just been it's been a ridiculous Six Nations.
Well, I think it's really interesting the way Schmidt deploys him on those set piece plays. It's really brave as a head coach to set up, you know, really, really well kind of regimental and researched plays to break down an opposition off your tight head. You know, and the way he made that pass to Bundiaki, I was covering the game, I was at it, and to be totally honest, which I had no idea what had happened. I couldn't.
No.
I couldn't work it
two
out.
Two or three times I couldn't.
It was so many angles and decoy runners, and in the middle of it all, you've got a tight head who's been lifting in the line out, as Dennis alludes to, hitting rucks with high intensity over a long period of time, scrummaging in the most difficult position to scrummage. And then to give him the responsibility of actually making a play where he's pirouettes and he passes blind to a guy who's coming at a completely opposite angle. I remember we played Wales, we lost to Wales last year, and Furlong, he knocked on twice as a first receiver. So it's not something, okay, he's excellent at it, but it's also something he's been put in the front line there, and he's got better at it as well. And he's very comfortable on the ball now, making passes behind strike runners as a decoy or actually hitting guys in. But I just find it phenomenal that a guy, a tight head, can do that at that level. It's hard enough as a 10 or 12.
Yeah, he credits Joe Schmidt with it. And Schmidt obviously tried it a couple of years ago against England as well. And that just tells me that the more we've got Joe Schmidt and the longer he is Ireland head coach, the better and better he is and the better he's getting. He's still not at potentially his peak as a head coach, which is a scary thought, really.
Yeah, I think ultimately you're looking at a guy who enjoys researching opposition, I think, who enjoys being locked away in a room and working out nuanced plays to break down an opposition, and arguably there's no one better at that kind of one-off magical kind of power play. And again, to pull it out of the flames like we did on Saturday, that one particular play I didn't realise, but I think Joe in his press conference just gave a little brief insight to having used it 4 years previously, and we realised it was probably going to work again based on the combinations of England's midfield. So yeah, I mean, an incredible student of the game.
That, sorry, I missed it. So 4 years ago.
Apparently 4 years ago we ran the same play against England and cut them open, and he pulled it out of his toolbox. He said he's only ever used it twice as a coach, both against England, both based on their defensive system in midfield, and it's so smart because Sexton has at times been criticised for overusing that loop he runs around, so the whole play is based on Sexton running that loop play, and in slow motion if you look at it, the England centre has turned his whole body outwards, anticipating Sexton's loop line, and Furlong hits Bundiaki into the space. So clever.
I think it was an individual error in 2015 that actually stopped it from being a try in the end. But as you said, they did open England up. Mm. Like, it's no coincidence, clearly, that this error count in crucial situations has dipped, because first of all, this is the first time we've been in a Grand Slam position under Joe Schmidt. So this was higher pressure than any other game we'd played under him, and we're making less errors. As I say, that is not a coincidence at all. Mm. Like, and it's the basics you do as a coach. Like, you'll be able to tell us as well that cutting errors out, doing things correctly is the basic. But when you're a professional, to go from that 95% to that 97% or whatever that is great testament to him to be able to reduce those errors in those tiny, tiny margins.
Mm. Well, his attention to detail on every detail, on every day at training is what sets him apart. I think there's the famous moment when he was, I think, about 2 weeks in with Leinster, and O'Driscoll got a ball around his shins, and I think Darcy had made the pass and put his hand up and said, sorry about the poor pass. And Schmidt turned around and said, well, I like to think good players can catch them. And suddenly O'Driscoll was knocked into shape, who was the king of Irish rugby at the time. So he doesn't suffer fools. He doesn't spare anyone the glare of his analysis. And I do think, aligned to that, players are pretty scared of making a mistake. But that's obviously no bad thing when it transfers straight into success at the highest level.
That was the debate. It was about, the team look like they're robotic and scared of making those mistakes to the point where they're not trying stuff. But you talk to some of the players who were around in the early days, and they point out that, like, the style of play was based on the fact that we had a bunch of really classically Gaelic football gifted high fielders of the ball. So we used to play that kicking game. You remember the first couple of years when we were winning championships, it was like we would kick the ball, Tommy Bowe would go and get it, or Rob Kearney would go and get it, or somebody else would go and get it. And that was him looking at his available talent. Mm. Now it's like, my talent is different, I'm going to play a different game. And so they are allowed to offload.
Yeah, there were some interesting stats going into the England game. Our front five forwards passed the ball the least of any front five forwards in the competition. That was including Italy. So he still has the shackles on, that's for sure. But you can't argue against him, because what's actually happening is albeit prescribed and prescriptive and robotic at times, it's robotic and successful, and it's what you would argue in hindsight, and it's easy to do in hindsight. He's built up a level of confidence through grinding out wins and through winning at times not in a pretty way, but who cares? Because you know, if you lose in a pretty way, you know, he's going to get
lambasted
anyway. And you know, I grew up watching Ireland play for 60 minutes in the late 80s and early 90s and playing some nice football, and then last 15 minutes falling away, and everyone went, yeah, well, that's our lot.
Yeah.
So I don't think we can be overly critical of a robotic style, provided it's successful.
You obviously have had some access, and this is the other part of it. He's very giving of his time to the Irish coaching fraternity, and he understands his role in Irish rugby. But you got some insight into the level of research that he does when he gave you access to some notes.
Yeah. It was about 3 or 4 years ago. By a funny kind of quirk of fate, one of our club players was He was more or less surplus to requirements with Leinster, but he was central to us as an amateur club. And we asked, could he be released for a crucial league game? And Joe said no. You know, we needed a 25th or 26th guy, and he was his employer, so it's absolutely fine. So I think he knew I was crestfallen by his decision and said, look, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, come in and I'll give you an example of what I do to analyse the opposition. So he pulled out a document. It was a couple of hundred pages worth. I figured it was his caseload for the whole year. And it was just his notes on a Glasgow game from a Friday night. So he had watched that game, I think, 6 or 7 times through, 80 minutes in full from various different angles. And he had taken that many notes. And this was Sunday evening, so it was probably 48 hours later. So I realised at that stage I'll never be a professional rugby coach. But I'd imagine he's developed from that again. And obviously, a lot of these guys have huge support staff and can delegate. Well, I actually think with Schmidt, there's a part of that approach that he loves that makes him feel prepared, that makes him feel very much central to his management role. He's a hands-on coach as opposed to a standoff director of rugby. You know, a lot of them can be quiet and cerebral in the background and you're not quite sure what they're actually doing.
Yeah.
Because they've got a head coach who's hands-on. I think Schmidt is very much the hands-on guy. You see him running the back line in the warm-up before the Six Nations games. He's sprinting around. He's all action. So, I mean, yeah, he's a different breed.
It's kind of inevitable at this point that he becomes All Blacks coach. And that is a terrifying thought, this Ireland team going up against an All Blacks team led by a man who knows more about Ireland than potentially any other coach in the country, given that amount of content that he's watched.
Yeah, it's a scary thought.
It only happens when we're already world champions, though, so it'll be all right.
We'll be the World Cup holders. So at that stage.
We can
the
take
game
that.
Has been completed.
Yeah.
Pretty much. One last thing I wanted to get your thoughts on kind of the younger players, just because Quinny mentioned earlier on about England and not so much the physical fatigue that they've experienced in this competition, but the mental fatigue. And obviously, when you bring in players like James Ryan and Dan Levy and the likes, they look at somebody like Johnny Sexton and his levels of professionalism, and they learn so much from that. They grow as a player because of that. But I suspect it works in the other way as well, that there is no mental fatigue in the camp because you've got this new breed of talent coming through, and the likes of Johnny Sexton and Conor Murray are seriously benefiting from that new energy in the camp.
Yeah, well, I think that's true for across the board in sport. When you look at successful sporting teams, Kilkenny under Brian Cody, Dublin with Jim Gavin, Manchester United under Fergie. I think Fergie set a premiership record of 77 premiership games in a row without picking the same starting 11. And when you're prepared to bring in young guys, which actually it probably has been quite a surprise in terms of we would criticise at times Schmidt's conservatism. He's been anything but in terms of a selection policy. He's bringing in guys like Larmour or Ryan who are unproven even at provincial level. So he's shown a huge...
Since the last World Cup.
Yeah.
Clearly somebody who can learn from his mistakes.
Absolutely,
and that's, you know, like, it's okay to criticise people, but you have to stop criticising them for doing stuff once they change.
Absolutely. I think... He was so chastened by that World Cup experience because we were a strong side going in, but the over-reliance on the senior pros within that team came back to bite him. And I think he's certainly taken it on board, but these young guys just add some freshness to the group that gives the Conor Murray and Johnny Sexton a lift. It probably gives everyone a kick up the arse and that, like, they've got to watch my back in terms of selection the following week. So yeah, it's super stuff.
A couple of quick other things on that. So there was a view expressed during the week, I can't remember where it was, but just that the leadership now is more diffuse than it would have been when it was O'Driscoll leading by example and O'Connell leading by example. So when either of those two come out of the team, like O'Connell does in the last World Cup, it's like, what the hell are we going to do now? Like, we would obviously feel the same if either Murray or Sexton went. Like, if they both went, you'd be really screwed. You'd feel like one or the other of them would actually be able to drag us through. So having Rory Best as the captain is actually, because he's not this totemic, I'm going to kill the opposition on my own figure. He's a far more, like...
It's a father figure.
It's hard to explain that without making it sound like you're somehow diminishing two of the greatest ever rugby players to play for Ireland. But you know what I mean?
Like, he seems like more of a Democrat, Rory Best. And I thought one of the really interesting things was, at one stage, it could have got close on Saturday, despite the fact we were definitely the better side in terms of execution as the game went on. But he didn't drag it out in terms of his substitutions. He took off Sexton, he took off Furlong, and he trusted the younger guys to go in. Carberry was on the field over 30 minutes in a Grand Slam decider. So he's diffusing that responsibility. The leadership is spread across the team. And it's menacing thought for any of our opposition in going into the next 18 months.
In a way, it makes the case for neither Sexton or Murray to be the next captain, that actually the best thing to do is not to burden them any further or to elevate them beyond where they are. Like, they're already obviously clearly on a plateau, so pick somebody else.
Yeah.
Like, if Best is going to have a period out of the team to keep them fresh for the World Cup, which wouldn't be the worst thing that ever happened.
Peter O'Mahony.
Yeah, well, I don't think there's any queries over Rory Best staying on for the next couple of years as it is. But if you're talking about the leadership as a whole throughout the group, I don't think there's any question over Murray and Sexton. I think Schmidt's biggest challenge in the next 18 months is wrapping them in cotton wool enough.
Yeah.
And getting the other guys in to manage, you know, God willing, the two lads remain fit and healthy for the next 18 months and as influential as they currently are on that side. But we do have to be smart and pragmatic, and we do have to cover in the event that something goes wrong with one of them in the lead up. And I think he's not only has he managed to do that in serious competitive internationals, he's actually done it in a Grand Slam decider, which is phenomenal in terms of the confidence that will give to the likes of Carberry. I think we need to make a decision, or certainly to give a lot more game time to the likes of Luke McGrath, Kieran Marmion also.
Yeah.
Because it's probably the one position where we have relied on Murray so much. Sexton's had more injuries, and therefore we've had to bring in other people. Murray's been very much fit, healthy, and reporting for duty at a high level every week. So I do think we need to be smart in the next 6 to 8 months and maybe the summer tour, you know, give Murray a break.
I think
like
there's,
that, you know?
Yeah, because the case will be made at the minute that you go down there and you win that tour in Australia. And it's the first time we've ever won a Southern Hemisphere tour. But ultimately, I don't know if that matters more.
Second, we won one. Ollie Campbell won one.
Oh, yeah, fair enough.
In
Sorry.
Australia, that's right. Yeah. Single-handedly, apparently.
So the value of that is huge, and I see the momentum and all that kind of stuff. But actually, if you have a first choice backup to Murray emerge, and you also have three tests for Joey Carberry, and you have three tests for Andrew Porter, and somebody else starts at hooker, and we win or lose, ultimately that's not going to dictate the fate of the group, but it will definitely accelerate the speed at which we get good.
Yeah, well, I think Schmidt has clearly got the respect of a nation now. I think if he, leading up to Australia, was transparent and said, we're going to use these games to develop players, I don't think anyone's going to have a problem if we lose 2-1 in a series by two or three young guys going out there and making a few mistakes. He's on the back of three championships and a Grand Slam, and he's looking to develop. And we all know what happened in the previous World Cup because of lack of depth. So I don't think there'd be a single argument if we managed to not have a successful summer tour, but three or four guys got 80 minutes at the highest level. So no doubt he will want to go and win 3-0 down there. But I think he could be forgiven for blooding a few players and the result maybe not going our way at that stage.
Andy, good stuff. Thanks a million.
Cheers, Chair.
Andy Dunn giving us some thoughts there on the Six Nations Grand Slam. We're going to be talking about this forever, it turns out, because that's how it works.
OTB AM.
In association with AIR. Get AIR Sport free with AIR Broadband.